You are listening to Journeys on Revolution Radio on freedomslips.com and simulcast with wolfspiritradio.com. Join JP, your tour guide today, on this journey of discovery from the known to the unknown in search of enlightenment, knowledge, and truth.
From C to Z, from Coast... Oh, no, sorry, wrong show. Hello, everybody, this is JP once again. Once again, it's Monday, it's Journeys with JP, and I've just been on Studio A for the last 2 hours, riding the saddle. Before that, I was on Journeys with JP and Rebecca on YouTube. We've got a new YouTube channel. We're doing wolfspirit.tv. It's really exciting. We're going to have... A lot of breakdown in the next few weeks on a Monday evening. It's just going to be, it's probably a Monday afternoon for you guys. But it'll be Rebecca Jernigan and I when is it? It's 1 p.m. PST, which is 4 Eastern. It'll just be an hour show, but we'll be talking about what her guides call the construct. What other may be known as the Archonic Grid, the Archonic Net, the Matrix, all the different names for it, the Great Illusion. All of these things we're going to be discussing and breaking down on Journeys with Rebecca and JP. And that's going to be Monday afternoon at 4 Eastern. So check out on wolfspirit.tv. This is the new stuff. This is the new stuff that's coming through. We're starting to do things on TV because, not because, really, I want to show my face, which is no great thing, but it means that we can show diagrams and we can even show movies and things moving and all that wonderful multimedia stuff that you can do in the 21st century, you know. It's like we're moving from the... Well, when did we have radio? We had radio at the beginning of the 20th century. We had TV by the 1950s. Some people had it by the 30s. Anyway, but this is the way it goes. We're progressing. Now we can all broadcast TV, and we can all have a conversation and get recorded and stored on YouTube. Marvellous stuff. So, that was this afternoon. This is now, today... This is the 2nd of November 2015, and Journeys with JP present today's show, which is about humanity's soul journey. My guest today is Krishana Duran, we're going to be zooming from the past to the future, from the far distant past to the far-flung reaches of the outer universe. See where that takes us. So, meeting with me on the launch pad. Hang on, let me just see if I can land the TARDIS. Yeah, over here. Yeah, land the TARDIS. My listeners will understand. The TARDIS is a time-space machine, so it enables us to move from time. And this is in operation. We move from this moment. To any point in history. Anyway, meanwhile, hang on, I'll just come back. All right, so now we're back November 2015. having completely bamboozled you, good afternoon, Krishana. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How about you, JP?
I'm very good. I've been having fun. You tend to get a bit crazy when you do too much broadcasting, because it's a very psychic thing, and you'll probably feel it as this show goes on. You know, when you speak to somebody, and there are loads and loads of people listening in the past and in the in the present and in the future, by way of archive and things like that. There are certain subjects that pop into your mind from the people who are listening. It's a very interesting thing. It happens. So,
I betcha.
So let's see where these kind of currents of thought and need and service take us. Would you like to introduce yourself to, because I'm, really not very good at doing this kind of thing.
I am a UFO experiencer. I have been all of my life. And I work with the material that I learned in my UFO contacts, starting when I was about, when I was six. They taught me to read and write because I would need to do that when I grew up. And then over the years, I've had periodic contacts with a variety of ET groups, which include Arcturians, who are basically Lemurians, Sirians, and I've had some contact with Pleiadians years and decades ago. And in 1963, I had a contact. I was 15 at the time. I lived in Oklahoma City. And they picked me up. I was walking on the street at dusk. They picked me up in a beam of light, took me on board the craft. I was there for a couple of hours. And that contact really set my life in motion, by directing me into a field of interest, which was, in the beginning, one of the things they told me is, you have lived many lives in the past, you will live many more in the future. And when I returned, I didn't know it at the time. I had grown up in a completely traditional Christian home. My father actually was a Nazarene minister. And I had never heard of any, I didn't even know world religions existed. I thought you were either a Christian or a Catholic, because my parents did not consider Catholics real Christians. So I had absolutely no background, no metaphysics. I had never heard of Atlantis. I had never heard of any of these things. And in fact, I didn't even know, I had never even heard the word reincarnation. After I was on the craft, they sent me back on near my home, and my life had totally changed. They basically did what I now know is a Kundalini initiation. I did not know it at the time. And I came back, and I could sense the life force in everything. And I soon told my mother that I had lived other lives, and she just panicked. And then when I turned 18, I decided the most important thing I could possibly do was find the life force and find out about my past lives. And all of this was done totally just from within my own experience. I still had never heard of metaphysics. I just had no knowledge of it. In 1980, and I did a lot of work with past life regressions in the 70s. 1980, I had another big contact. 1985, I had a bigger contact. And in 1992, I had another defining contact. By defining, it set my life in a totally different direction. With the Mayan calendar, finding the truth of the Mayan calendar. In that contact, I learned about the Earth grid, and that the best model for an Earth grid is 5 interpenetrated tetrahedra. In 1993, I investigated a crop circle in Kennewick, Washington. I lived in Seattle, Washington at the time, and when I stepped into that crop circle, it was like stepping into a holodeck, and I could see all the energy flowing towards the south. And that began my study of the Mayan calendar. And by then I had I had discovered metaphysics. I had learned about the New Age. I was totally satisfied with my understanding of my many past lives and the past lives of other people. I would not say that I was a New Ager per se, but at my training and my inclination was very much towards the Hindu and the Tibetan as it related to Native America, largely because I'm a Cherokee descendant, and I had worked with Wallace Black Elk by that time, by 1992 and 93. So what I do now, I've spent 23 years. I've done a lot of work with models of time, time travelers. I've done predictions for Earth changes for 20 years. I've had some really good success with that. And at this point, we are now moving into I call it a dual stream of energy. The 2012 was sort of a symbol for that. It started much earlier, and it will continue much longer, but 2012 was the tipping point. I know a lot of people are interested, what do we do now? 2012 has come and gone.
Yeah.
And if you look at key points, you know, if you look at, if you establish what are your markers for change, there have been tremendous changes since 2012. However, in our culture, the Judeo-Christian culture of America and Europe, the expectation of prophecy is basically represented in revelations, and which is totally removed from the natural cycles of the planet, of the earth, and even the heavens, the galaxy, the sun. It's just and so my work has been, what are the natural cycles? What cycles are we dealing with? How do they affect us as humans, the natural world that we live in, and what are your markers when you know that change, significant changes have occurred? JP?
Okay, so time markers. Now, you touched on so many points. I wanted to. So let's just take it from the point where you left it. So you've got these what you call time markers. Is that right?
You have markers in experience and energy. Right now, we are experiencing enormous extinction events, die-offs in the natural world. Some of them are Fukushima, but they started long before. Well, the first one that I predicted and happened was in 2011, before Fukushima. Fukushima was basically an outcome of a larger cycle. So your die-offs, your extinctions, the capacity to thrive in an environment, those are markers of the well-being, or of the stability, like the habit or the novelty of a world. I use a lot of Terence McKenna's
time. Oh, I see. So you're talking like a barometer of how society is successful or healthy, yeah?
Exactly. Or a species.
Okay.
I use a lot of Terence McKenna's Time Wave Zero, which is a sort of a long story to explain what it really is. It took me about 10 years to really understand what it was representing and how to use it for prediction. And I ended up using that, time wave zero, which is about morphogenetic forms, or that's sort of redundant, but it's about the morphogenesis of ourselves as a species and the world in which we live, and the morphogenetic memory, morphogenetic habit, and periods of novelty when you move out of habit and into a new cycle or a new form of being. And we hit that point in 2012. And I will say that one of my best predictions, it still shocks me when I think about it, is that in 2002, using a combination of time wave zero, which is when I really understood what it was representing as habit, and my own time star, which is 5 interpenetrated tetrahedra, I predicted, and I post all my predictions in an archive that are date stamped, that if the U.S. was going to invade Iraq, it would be between March 15th and April 1. And I drew that date from a combination of those two systems, time wave zero and my own time star. And Bush invaded Iraq on March 19th. So that was really a great one. And we have been, since that date, in constant conflict in the Middle East. It is the conflict between that is occurring there drives the world, drives the direction of our cultures. Even Russia has now lost a jet yesterday with 224 passengers. And they have been pretty clear, the Russians, that it was not a mechanical failure, that it was an external force used on that Russian jet, and ISIS has claimed responsibility for it. So since that date in 2002, this whole Middle Eastern thing has just been a driving force in the condition of the world, and I did predict the date that the period.
So, Christiana. Sorry, I just want to there we go. Sorry, I just want to bring you back. Hang on, having a bit of an issue with my microphone here. Oh dear, come on. I want to bring you back to the right. You can hear me, okay?
Oh, yeah, I can hear you fine.
Okay, good. I'd like to bring you back to the time wave. One of the things that I'm interested in is the exact point of origin that you place it, because there's been a controversy as to whether to put that first time at Hiroshima or some other point, like when the Manhattan Project was moved. Where do you place your baseline on the time wave?
I mark my baseline with Terence McKenna. I have found that to be an effective baseline, and it's with 1945. But you've got to remember that in 1945, before Hiroshima, is when we did our first atomic test at Trinity. So that whole 1945 period is an effective one. But I also use 1942 for several reasons. 1942 is when they began the Philadelphia experiment. 1942 is also the year when sustained, where nuclear fission was sustained for the first time, because the Germans had done a lot of experimenting, but they couldn't get sustained nuclear fission. And in 1942 we did, and that was the Manhattan Project. In 1942, we had two other very, very important things happen. One of them was the Battle of L.A., where a UFO appeared over Los Angeles for 30 minutes, and millions of people saw it. And that was, the amazing thing is that it was so novel that people just didn't, they couldn't even respond. I know a guy who was a kid when that, he remembers it. He was a kid when that happened, and people were just too stunned to even respond. So 1942 was very big. 1942 is also the year that Winston Churchill classified the Foo Fighters or UFOs as top secret. So it was a huge year, and you just can't reject it. But then you get it's almost like a 3-year period, and then in 1945 you get the actual uses of atomic energy with the first test, and then bombing Japan.
So here's the interesting, several interesting points. Regular listeners of Journeys with JP will know my incredible interest in the Bell project, the Glocker project, and I know that you've had, you've had interest in the secret societies of Germany and that kind of ilk, and that it had a context within these societies. Would you like to kind of put some dots together for us?
Well, yes, and I'm not quite sure how you knew that, because. But tell me, explain what you mean by a context for those dots.
All right. So, well, I've been talking about the... I read a book. It all came from... I read a book, and it was called Die Glocke, and it was about the development of the Nazi Bell.
Right.
Which was a massively top-secret thing, and the only reason that we know about it is because of the leaked journal of the man who was eventually to be known as Wolf Davis. And it's his private journals from the days when he was working on Die Glocke before he was taken into Paperclip. And he's the only person who survived the massacre at Castle Gzass that killed everybody, because he knew of the secret tunnels in the old castle, and there was some secret tunnels that he knew about, and that saved his life and saved this this account. These are the journals of the Die Glocke Project Risa, development of Serum 525 and what they call Vril, and it also connects together with the channels of the Vril Society and the being who he calls Alquan, who was the Aldebaranian who contacted them, supposedly. So at that point, I imagine that you have but what the context is that the secret societies in Germany were doing something much bigger than what the Nazis were trying to do. And that's the context that I'm talking about.
Okay. I'll tell you what I know. I was almost sent you a manuscript this week and decided I'd just wait until we could talk about it. What I have is a manuscript. It's the last book that Wendell Stevens wrote. Now, Wendell Stevens was the first and primary investigator in the Billy Meier contact case back in 1974. And I don't know if you're familiar with him. What I liked about him, Wendell Stevens...
I am indeed.
You are indeed. And so he was a pilot for three different air forces, the American, the Bolivian, and the Chinese. And he would just go to a UFO site where there's been a contact. He'd just look and talk to people, and he reported what he found. It was not fancy, but it was real straightforward, and he was very honest in his reporting. So the last book he did was about the Nazi Bell. It has never been widely distributed. He sent me a copy before it was published. So I just happened to have that, and I was going to send that to you. From what Wendell found out, after World War I, when Germany was just bankrupt, a lot of scientists who were unemployed would gather at the Berlin Library and just have coffee every morning. And from that, they started speculating about different technology and different science. And they then found a psychic named Maria Orsic. Are you familiar with her?
Now, Maria, she deserves another. Because we're very familiar with Maria. Very beautiful. And perhaps very, very evil. Who knows what her agenda was and who she really was.
Exactly.
She's very mysterious, isn't she? There's a long story there somewhere. There was some long hair as well.
Yes. All of those psychics had let their hair grow. They thought it was an antenna. Which, you know, you could go into that, but we don't want to at this point. You know, the different ways of it, of using the physical energy. But they found Maria Orsic, and she began to channel for these scientists. And she was writing the information down, and they finally, and it was in a weird language, and they finally figured out that it was an archaic, an ancient form of Sumerian. And it turned out that they thought, these scientists figured out eventually that these channeled materials that Maria Orsic was giving them in ancient Sumerian was some kind of an energy source or an energy device, and they began to work on it. And they were really proud of their work. They talked about it, they published it, and they developed it into the 30s, and it was totally at that point from the 20s, and that was in the 20s, and then into the 30s it was totally these private scientists doing that work. In 1938, I think it was 38, when Hitler decided, he invaded Poland, had to make hard decisions. What's he going to develop? What isn't he going to develop? Like, he decided to not develop the atomic bomb because he wouldn't have time. It would take too long. He needed a lot of power fast. And they did develop anti-gravity inadvertently. What Hitler did is he recruited all of the scientists who had been working on this Bellcraft privately, and the psychics into the SS, put them on the SS payroll. And the Americans picked up the atomic research, and what we know is that they were able to get the Bellcraft airborne. Wendell said when he was working for the Bolivian Air Force, he talked to former Nazi pilots, and they told him, yeah, we had the Bellcraft, and we could get it airborne, but they had trouble controlling it. They never really figured that one out. But they apparently, using that technology, that energy source that they had gotten from the Sumerian, which turned out to be Aldebaran, they were able to time travel. But that was inadvertent also. They didn't intend to do it. So now we're looking at after 1938, up until the end of World War II, when Russia went into Germany, and the Americans and the Russians were into a race to see which one could get the most German technology. And in the meantime, we had the Philadelphia experiment with Tesla, 1942-1943. So the context of what the German people were trying to do is in the book, in the manuscript that Window gave me, he had a reference to a book of a German family who had repeated UFO contacts with Aldebarans, and they had been on the UFOs with incubators where they were incubating little German babies. And the Aldebarans explained to them that they had created bred a race of workers on Earth 780,000 years ago, and then they left. And when they returned, all the workers had rebelled. So they gathered up the workers that were most similar to the Aldebarans, and began working specifically with them, and they became the Germanic people. And that book is, which has also diagrams of the motors, the power sources for the Bell Crafter in my book. I use it as a reference. And so from that, okay, now from that you get some really interesting correlations, because about that period, 780,000 to 800,000 years ago, which is long before your Homo sapien, long before Neanderthal, you find the Boskop skulls in Africa. And Boskop was the name of an African village. And the Boskop skulls are almost identical to modern human skulls. Same capacity, virtually the same cranial capacity. So the cranial capacity, the ability to house the brain, is what distinguishes the various human species, you know, like Homo sapiens sapiens, Cro-Magnon. And the Boskop skulls, which were discovered in Africa around 1914, thereabouts, are huge, have a huge cranial capacity, and the dating on them is very close to the date given by the German family who had the many contacts, and the Aldebarans described their genetic projects on Earth, which was 780,000 years ago. So the Aldebarans have now told us they've been developing workers longer than anything the Sumerians can possibly claim, that they became the German people, and frankly, the German people have had a sense of being the master race since day one. Like, it just simply is the fact, you know.
Let me just let people who know me will know that is exactly my experience in the last 3.5 years. I need say no more. Thank you very much.
That's
so,
okay.
Please go on.
All right. So the Germanic people, as I said, have been bred. I believe that that has, that they were specifically bred, because remember, the Aldebarans gathered up all the workers that were most like them, and they became the German people. So they were oriented, they were developed to be the master human race on this planet. And it's, you know, if we go into morphogenetic memory, that's a part of their breeding. And you can actually breed that into a species, physically and culturally, psychologically. So that's the background, and I don't think the German people are bad at all. In fact, some of the changes I've seen among Germans since World War II are pretty impressive in my book. I see a real effort to humanize the German people among certain, you know, there's a whole trend of, of humanizing.
Oh yeah, you know, I'm, you know, I don't want to be racist about this, but like, you know, I'm doing a lot better than my parents, let me say.
And because,
you know, I'm half Jewish and half Catholic, and, you know, my parents, you know, I wouldn't be here were it not for Adolf Hitler invading somewhere, you know, because my dad came over from Canada saying he could speak English. Well, anyway, long story. But anyway, so the... Here's how we're here and why we're here is to figure out this puzzle.
That's exactly correct.
And it's fantastic that you're here. You've got a load of bridging pieces there, Krishana. This is what I and hopefully my listeners are enjoying, fitting these little nuggets into the puzzle that we've already been looking at. And okay, so yes, Wendell Stevens, excellent stuff. And so the context of wanting to create some... So here's the thing, right? So what the Aldebaranians were doing were what the Aldebaranians do, and what the Nazis were doing were what the Aldebaranians do. In fact, that's what they've been doing all through history, no matter what they've been called. They've been sorting out the ones that are most like them and putting them into positions of power. However, sadly, there is corruption in there, and there is darkness and evil and torture and maiming and other kind of deals that have been done. So what happened to those workers, and why is everybody so twisted?
What happened to the German workers that, or the workers that became the German people?
Yes, yes.
Well, they basically, at this point, are just flowing into this, the mainstream of humanity. I have to say also, my father, my mother was half Cherokee. My father could not have been more Germanic. He was a Dutchman with he was a towhead with the lightest blue eyes you've ever seen. Okay, so I know these people really well. I know the Germanic people, I know the Dutch people, because I grew up with them. My grandfather, my father was essentially first generation born in America, so I knew them well. But you know, you can make... Okay, we're talking about time wave zero. So, time wave zero is your basic pattern of habit and novelty, or morphogenetic memory, that is contained in both planetary fields, human fields. And your as an example, Bruce Lipton, who wrote The Biology of Belief, said, one of his turning points was he was growing massive colonies of cells. And what he found is he could take exactly the same cells that were absolutely identical. You put them in one environment and they become bone. You take exactly the same identical cell, you put it in a different environment, it becomes muscle. And so your environment and your field in which you're operating in radically alters or even is determines the form that a cell will take, that a life form will take. So time wave zero, it's a initiating point that Terence McKenna found was 275,601 years ago. And when Terence was alive and doing his research, he did not yet, the studies that have now been done had not yet been done. But that day, 275,000 years ago, roughly corresponds with several key events in the human species. One of them is that is just about when Neanderthal began using tools. Neanderthal had been on the planet, but he wasn't a tool user until just about that date. And that's just about the date that the Arcturians say they introduced Bigfoot, who is a human species, onto this planet with a very specific job to do. And the point I'm making here is that the environmental conditions, the planetary fields that shaped Neanderthal and Bigfoot were at a nexus or a turning point at the beginning of time wave zero, and that ended, that cycle ended in 2012. So that's I handle that as a morphogenetic cycle of establishing an early humanity in a planetary environment that changes. And in 2012, it was like, that was the end of our gestation. As a human species, we are, at Homo sapiens sapiens is about 100,000 years old. Our earliest modern human ancestors go back to just about the beginning of time wave zero. That had not been found definitively before Terence McKenna died. If it had, he might have changed some of his views on time wave zero, but that's the way it is. So you can introduce your qualities and the features you want in a human species, but those will be shaped by environmental conditions and the condition of the planetary field. And so now we are consistently, all of us are Homo sapiens sapiens. We are the product of many, many ET races, ET interventions, including the Aldebarans. We come forward at this point in our history with three main lines of evolution. I believe they're the ones I posit, which are Aldebaran, who has always been trying to be the master race. You get your Sumerians, which is your Judeo-Christian culture and those people. And then the third one are the Arcturians, who are the Lemurians. And we are now very comparable at this time in our history, regardless of our genetic origins, we're now very comparable as a species, as a modern human species. And our ancestors, we've had numerous ancestors, we've had numerous interventions by ET groups. And 2012 was the end of the cycle, and it was our tipping point. I'm going to quote Lynn Buchanan, who, I don't know if you're familiar with him. If you ever saw Men Who Stare at Goats, which is about remote viewing, the lead role in that was modeled after Lynn Buchanan. He is an incredibly outstanding remote viewer. And he remote viewed 2050. And what he found, and by the way, he remote viewed Rendlesham Forest UFO incident. He did that in 1986, and he drew a UFO that is identical to what Jim Peniston described in 2010. That is how good Lynn Buchanan is. And in 2050, what he found is that the population of the earth is greatly reduced, and those who survive are hybrids. And he said very clearly, the hybridization did not occur recently. The input from the ET genetics was from earlier in our history. And I have a link to his interview where he talked about that on my website. So, and he remote viewed that 2012 was the tipping point. It's like what you see is what you get at 2012. Before 2012, we could change, alter our future to some degree, but at 2012, we reached a tipping point, and we're just living out now what has already been set in motion. And by 2050, the majority of those who are alive on this planet in a greatly reduced population are hybrids of who, so the hybrids, it appears from what he said that your hybridization follows certain lines. Like he said, it's not just one hybrid. There'll be some grays, hybrid grays. There'll be some hybrid Nordics. And he didn't say it, but there'll probably be some hybrid reptilians too. So that is where the Aldebarans fit in. Any advantage that they got from that early breeding that the Aldebarans did, I just think it's leveled out, it's evened out. The culture and the mindset of incredible racism was evened out to a large degree when Germany lost the war, World War II. But I will tell you, and I can't remember the exact date, in the 30s, I think it was, a Native American named Jim Thorpe went to the Olympics, and he just wiped out everyone. He won like five medals, and he was just a Native American guy who had gone to a Christian boarding school, which is a different story. Well, that just set the world on its ear. The European, and the, I believe it was the King of Sweden, complained so badly, so loudly about it, that they ended up stripping Jim Thorpe of his medals. The King of Sweden, his big complaint was that Thorpe had played semi-pro baseball before the Olympics, so that disqualified him. And they did take his medals away from him. And today, that's nothing. I mean, that many Olympic athletes play sports before they go to the Olympics, and it's not an issue. It's not a problem. Well, Sports Illustrated named Jim Thorpe as the athlete of the century for the first half of the 20th century in 2000. In 2000, Sports Illustrated named Jim Thorpe as athlete of the century. There was no one who ever did what Jim Thorpe did. And with such a broad range of sports. And so any advantage that the Germanic people may have ever had racially has been pretty much leveled out with the rest of us through the consequences of their own actions, which is karma, which you see in World War II, with the greater ability of other racial groups like Native Americans. And so about the only thing that's left that really gives the master race any supremacy, as far as I can tell, is a dwindling belief in it. it gets harder and harder to sustain a belief in the supremacy of the Aryans. And their technology, which we now know has been largely supplemented by the Aldebarans, like the German people were their ancestors or their descendants, and they wanted them to be the master race. That whole engineering was Aldebaran. Wasn't necessarily the German people who set out to be the master race, but it was important to the Aldebarans, I believe, that their descendants would rule the earth. And very much the same way that the Sumerians wanted their descendants to rule the earth. Where in Genesis 10, in the Table of Nations, the earth was given to Adam and Eve's descendants. And that's where we are now. Right now we've got Adam and Eve's descendants in the Middle East battling for Netanyahu. Last week made the statement he would not give any territory, there would not be a second state, and he would live by the sword and fight to the death. There's Adam and Eve's descendant today. And then you get to the Aldebarans, you get the Nazis, who after World War II, really, they knew they were losing the war, and they were prepared for the Fourth Reich, and launched the Fourth Reich even before the end of the war. So those two groups, whose ET parents had agendas for them, right, like Adam and Eve's descendants were the chosen people, and the Aldebarans, Aryan Nazis, were the master race, are the two groups that keep this planet in turmoil. And sooner or later, people are going to get over their religious dogma, and they're going to come to terms with the fact that this planet has been managed and driven into the ground by ET ancestors who are fighting proxy wars through humans. And in the meantime, the human species has pretty much homogenized to a very large extent. Now, I would tell you in Wendell Stevens, in his research, in the book that he wrote, his last one, he said he found people, German people, who had direct contact with Aldebarans before and during the war. And he has pictures in it. And Wendell said that, or concluded, that the reason the Aldebarans gave the scientists, who were private citizens at that time, the technology, for the Nazi Bell, was because they thought that if we could have cheap travel, that we would be able to mingle with other cultures, and that would help us resolve some of our conflicts. And when they saw what Hitler had done, that Hitler had confiscated all that technology and the scientists and the psychic, that the Aldebarans sent people in who sabotaged the Bell so that it would never work the way they wanted it to. I will be happy to give you a copy of that book.
I would be honored and joyful, and I would actually read it out on air, just to get it out.
Okay. Yeah, I'll send it to you in a few minutes. So does that answer your question about where do we stand with the German people now?
Well, I mean, this is exactly, you exactly answered it. What is the context of this conflict? And it's basically Aldebarans, mm-hmm. and who's the other group who formed Adam?
The Sumerians.
The Sumerians. Now, the Sumerians come from where?
Well...
because they sound like an equivalently technologically advanced race to the Aldebaranians.
Well, they are.
Because I always thought that the Sumerians were the Aldebaranians, but okay, but there's other stuff going on here.
There's a very strong connection between them. And I've never completely been able to squash out.
Krishana, we're up against a hard break right now.
Okay.
We'll be back in about 3, 4, 5 minutes. Go make a tea, visit the bathroom, or listen to these things, and then give some money to Revolution Radio, a listener-supported station. Yes. Don't go away. This is very exciting stuff. Welcome back to Journeys with JP. Here we are on Revolution Radio, a 110% listener-supported station. Please visit the support page. So that's freedomslips.com/support. And then you'll find various things that might attract your attention. Or you can support us with a few dollars here and there. More here than there. Anyway... thank you very much. This is Journeys, and my guest tonight, Krishana Duran. And where were we? We were talking about the Nazis. I always get to talk about the Nazis on the show, but it's important. All right, so we're talking about the different streams. So you've got the Sumerians. Now, why is everybody laying claim to Sumer? Why does everybody want to be? Why is everybody saying, this is my land? You know, why is everyone, oh, God gave me this place? You know, this area, you know, we're talking the Middle East, you know, in general, you know, not just Israel, but, you know, that whole area is always in dispute. They're always warring. They're always saying, give me some of this, give me some of that. And what is it? Is this a bunch of dirt? What the hell's going on?
That's right. Well, what you have there, in my opinion, is... A lot of confusion and a lot of really undeveloped identity of the soul. The original fight started, the one that we're living out right now, started with Abraham and his descendants when the Lord, who was probably a combination of several different ETs, but promised Abraham that his descendants would populate the earth. They'd be more numerous than the stars in the heavens and the sand on the beach. And then he was sterile. Sterility was a big problem back then. If you start looking at these stories, Abraham was 90-odd years old. I think he was 95. His wife, Sarai, was in her 60s, and they didn't have an heir. So Sarah ordered her servant, who was Hagar, to sleep with Abraham and give him an heir. And Hagar did that. She conceived Ishmael. Hagar did not want Ishmael, by the way. When she found out she was pregnant, she was very distressed. The Lord appeared to her and spoke to her and told her that he would be I believe the words were, a wild donkey of a man, and to go ahead and give birth to the baby. And after that, Sarah conceived Isaac. And I guess Ishmael was maybe 12 years older than Isaac. And after Sarah had her own child, she basically abandoned Hagar, put her out in the desert with Ishmael to die. And the Lord again sent an angel to save Hagar and Ishmael. So, and Abraham loved Ishmael. So it's real clear that the Lord and Abraham both wanted Ishmael and Isaac, but Sarah was was jealous, and she just didn't want Ishmael.
Sarah was a bitch. What a bitch.
Sarah was a bitch, and it even states it in the Bible that because of the conflict between the women, which was Hagar and Sarah, they would be plagued with fighting and wars. So Ishmael fathered the 12 tribes of Islam, and Isaac, through Jacob, fathered the 12 tribes of Israel. And the battle to this very day is that the Jews say that they are entitled, they are more entitled to the land than Ishmael's descendants, who are the Muslims. And the fact that Abraham and the Lord both wanted Ishmael as much as they wanted Isaac doesn't fathom the Jewish story. But you got to remember who wrote the Jewish story. It was the Jewish scribes. God didn't write those scriptures. The Lord didn't write those scriptures. It was the Jewish people wrote the scriptures, this portion of them, after they were released from captivity in Babylon in the 6th century B.C. Very recent, really, as a history. So that is where that battle is, I believe. That's the genesis of it. And it's just but if you look at the Old Testament, the seed or the morphogenetic memory of this started with when Cain slew Abel. In other words, Adam and Eve have their first two sons, and one kills the other. And then you go down to Abraham, and he has his two sons, and they're still trying to kill each other, right through their descendants. So that is a pattern, a psychological pattern among those people, among the descendants of Adam and Eve. They claim to be the descendants of Adam and Eve, and they are. But when you look at who Adam and Eve were, the picture starts getting clearer, because Adam and Eve were just another genetic experiment on this planet who attempted to claim dominance of the earth through those particular descendants and by killing off everybody else. That's what Genesis is all about. If you read the first 11 chapters of Genesis, it just marches right through that sequence. In Genesis 10, you have the Table of Nations, where the Lord gives everything to the Jews. Again, the Jews are the ones who wrote those scriptures. And then in Genesis 11, you have the Tower of Babel, where anyone else who tried to build would get, their languages were confused, and their civilization was scattered. And the fact is that there really was a global language 12,500 years ago. References are in my book on that. You can trace it. 12,500, well, actually, the earliest point of that language that I know of is 15,000 years ago. But 12,500 years ago, the crossroad of that language was in Turkey, which happens to be northern Mesopotamia, extended all the way up into Turkey. Haran, or Haran, which was an important city in Mesopotamia, was in what is now modern Turkey. So your Tower of Babel is actually largely because of the widespread acceptance of the Old Testament as God's inspired word, is now our archetype. And we saw it repeated at the Twin Towers when those were bombed. It was the towers were destroyed again. And now they're in the process of playing out this whole process of scattering civilization. We have more refugees today. We have as many refugees today as they did at the end of World War II. The Ukrainians are scattered. The Syrians are scattered. And it's just a replay of the Tower of Babel. Now, where did this come from? We see this whole pattern, Genesis, starting with Adam and Eve's sons, who, when one murdered the other, and then again with Abraham's sons, when Isaac and Ishmael were pitted against each other by their mothers. And so where did that start? My theory, a possible explanation for this, is that when the Sumerian gods, Ea, Enki, the whole bunch, came to this planet, they brought other people with them. And that these people are a soul group. And that their wars really didn't even start on this planet. They brought those wars with them. It's a part of their morphogenesis on this planet. Is this war for dominance between two brothers? That's my answer.
So the archetype, right, if I get this right, because what you're talking in my terms would be fractal realities. That the form of all of these realities all stem from the initial Ea Enki conflict. Who are the children of Anu? Yes.
Exactly. In that particular group, like what I'm saying is that those people who are involved in the Islam-Israel conflict are actually a soul group, and their conflict actually started long before they came to this planet. That they came to this planet, actually, I say they came from Mars. That Sitchin's interpretation of Nibiru is way off base, and with good reasons, because I think that I think the Sumerian gods were pretty cagey about what they tell us and what they told us, and that the errors were in the actual text that Sitchin interpreted. But on the text he interpreted about Nibiru, you'd have to be a full-blown prophet to interpret those. They've gotten so confused down through the millennia. And then on top of that, I don't think the Sumerian gods were completely honest about their origins. Anthony Sanchez has in UFO Highway says they were from Mars. And that really makes a lot of sense, because if you look at Mars' atmosphere, it's been badly damaged for a long time. And according to Sitchin, when I believe that this part is probably true, they originally came to this planet seeking gold because they had a problem with their atmosphere. Their atmosphere was dying, and they needed the gold to buffer their own atmosphere. And that perfectly fits with Mars. And according to Sanchez, the Sumerians, the Sumerian gods, that first generation of Ea and Enki, the son of Anu, that species had originated in Zeta Reticula and then had migrated to Sirius for a while before they went to Mars. They had been on Mars for about 1 million years, 900,000 years, when they were forced to leave because their atmosphere was so badly damaged. This planet was not, the Earth, was not really good for them. that was not really suitable for them. They had to genetically engineer their species to an extent to survive here, because we're going back to the planetary fields, the morphogenetic fields, and the species and how that affects species. So they, a group they called their progenitors, engineered their reptilian species, engineered that reptilian species, hybridized them with an Earth species to make them compatible with this planet. That original blonde, because they were blondes, that original blonde species of the Sumerian gods, were, like I said, a hybridized species of reptilians with strains from this planet to make them compatible. And then they went into the hybrid making business themselves. You know, in Numa Elish, the Babylonian charter myth, the Anunnaki Council, the Anunnaki was the name for the gods of Sumer, had decreed to create workers. And their lives would be 120 years long. But those workers are not the same as the Adam and Eve. It gets a complex tracking all these workers, and I'm positive the Enuma Elish says yes, they created workers who lived 120 years, and then later you got Adam and Eve's descendants, and they had very long lives, like 969 years for Methuselah, 175 for Abraham. So you had a number of Sumerian hybrids. Some were created as workers, some were created as exalted workers to take the place of scientists, of the Sumerian scientists. And I think they brought this with them, this psychology came with them when they migrated to the Earth, because Mars was dying and they had no place else to go.
So are you saying that both tribes came here, or both groups?
Well, both groups are the same people. Mm-hmm. They were both the children of Abraham's children. Mm. The Muslims and the Jews are both the children, Abraham's descendants.
It's very interesting. You talk about 12 of each.
Yes.
And so is there a kind of parallel but opposite thing with Judaism and Islam? With the 12, because I've never really been exposed to the Islamic 12. You want to talk about that a bit?
Well, they're the Bedouin. They're basically the Bedouin tribes who became Muslim with Muhammad about 600 A.D. They were just the desert people. The indigenous tribal people, if you want to call them indigenous, they grew up in that desert. That's who they were. And that's who the Hebrews were. Really and truly, that's who they really were. Because you have Abraham, and he fathered Ishmael, who became the father of the tribes of Islam. And then you had Isaac, who became the father, once removed, from the tribes of Israel, and they were both Abraham's descendants. Now, Jacob gave birth to the 12 tribes. You know, the 12 fathers of the 12 fathers of the tribes of Israel. But if you do just a little bit of basic math on this, where did all these, I mean, the scriptures claim that there were 600,000 Jews left Egypt. Where did you get 600,000 people from this? From these 12 in just a few generations. So they were definitely marrying other people.
Yeah, where did all the girls come from? Where are all these fine, and they must have been doing the whole polygamy thing. Lots of wives.
They were, and they were recruiting Jews. You know, they
Jewish
had...
Jewish princesses. How lovely.
Jacob had...
What could go wrong? Can I just say, what could go wrong if you tried to get two Jewish princesses to cooperate? I mean...
what you get...
What could go wrong? Let me just underline that. Just like the Germans, the Jewish princesses have a particular way of being. I say no more. Thank you. Please, Christiana, please continue.
Okay. Pardon me.
I'm sorry. So, anyway, yeah.
Meanwhile, Jacob had 13 children. Let me start. Go.
Jacob.
That.
Yeah, okay.
Jacob, who fathered the 12 tribes, had 13 children. The 13th was a daughter named Dinah. And there's a story in the Old Testament where a neighbor raped her. So her brothers went after this neighbor. And they apparently circumcised him. Maybe his whole tribe, who knows. But if you go to King David, and he wanted to marry King Saul's daughter in order to win King Saul's approval, he circumcised more than 100 Gentiles. So once you were circumcised, you had the mark of Israel on you. And the people who were being circumcised were just the desert people of that area. They were the Bedouin tribes.
So there were two... who was doing the circumcision then? And was it just an intertribal thing, or is there an outside, you know, who, where's the extra, is there an extraterrestrial force in this?
On the circumcision?
Yeah, I mean, who's, because it's like, it's, I'm owning you, you know, it's the real big, I'm owning you kind of thing. So
yeah.
Who started that? Who started this in the first place?
Well, the Lord, remember when Abraham, saw the burning bush, and he made a covenant with the Lord, and that's when the Lord told him to circumcise. But an important point on this is that the ancient circumcisions were not the same as the modern. The ancient circumcisions were like basically trimming away a little skin. And what they do today is radical circumcision, which can cause nerve damage. I mean, it's very, very serious what they do today as a circumcision. And from what I understand, that concerns me a lot. And what's happening to babies? From what I understand, the radical circumcision started when the Jewish boys went to the anciently went to the Olympics and tried to pull what little foreskin they had left down to look like the other boys, you know, like the Greeks who weren't circumcised. And the Jewish elders then started doing radical circumcisions, so there was no way you could hide your Judaism at the Olympics when everyone went naked anyway. That is what I understand.
So it's all about the schmeckle.
Yeah, that's what it's really all about. And it was your mark of your Jewishness that you were circumcised. And if you tried to hide it and look like the other non-circumcised boys, the Jewish elders just gave you a radical circumcision.
So,
but all through, you've got to remember, all through Africa, you have circumcision. Right, like in Africa, you have female circumcisions, which are just insane. They circumcise the clitoris. So that came out of that out of Africa. That's prevalent in Africa. In fact, there was a supermodel whose name I don't remember. Beautiful, beautiful woman. She was African, and she did a huge crusade because she had been circumcised as a young girl.
Okay, so moving upwards from, and onwards, because every time you say the word circumcised, I can feel this blade go shh. It's just a thing. It's probably a Jewish thing. I don't know what, you know, I don't know. But, and so, okay, so let's face it. Let's take a breath. And so, we're still talking about Ea and Enki.
Yes.
And one of them, I mean, is like the outcast. The one who is, you know, whoever's idea it was to send the girl into the desert with her baby to die.
That was Sarah's idea.
Sarah. Okay, so Sarah's not doing too well in the tyranny stakes, is she?
In the what thing?
Tyranny. What she's trying to do is a tyrannical thing, is to completely annihilate any competition. Who does that?
Absolutely. Well, that is a very reptilian characteristic, isn't it? Yes. Sarah was Abraham's sister, according to the Bible. She would have probably been his half-sister. Hagar was a slave, a servant, that Sarah ordered to go to Abraham and conceive a child for him. So Sarah has already stepped in it, in my book, by the very idea of sending a servant to conceive a child so your husband will have an heir. Then you get your own child and you say, you're out of here. Take that kid and go to the desert. And they abandoned her in the desert. That's very tyrannical.
And so the story of Hagar is the untold story of the Islamic people. Is that right?
Right.
Is that why they're so pissed? And we don't know why. And now we know why.
Well, it's bred into, it's a cultural...
Yeah.
It's a mindset. It's a mindset. It's so, a psychological thing, and the Israelites are as angry as the Muslims.
As the Ishmaelites.
They're like two peas in a pod.
Yeah.
They came from the same father. They came from the same cultural paradigm, and frankly, ISIS operates a lot like Israel did in the Six Days War. I mean, I don't know if you remember the Six Days War. And
I think I was only six or something.
Well, I remember. That was 1967.
Yep, I was six.
Israel just came out of its borders. It made the Nazis look like pikers. You know, I had a friend who fought in the Six Days War, who told these incredible stories. He of course immigrated to the U.S. shortly after that war. But Israel just came out and it was like a blitz. And they took the Golan Heights, they took the West Bank, and they just said, this is ours, we're taking it. And it caught the world by surprise. It would just happen one morning. They just broke out of their borders. So that's exactly what ISIS is doing right now. They're just, their whole mindset, their whole way of thinking, their playbook is very, very similar. And they're both saying, I'm right and you're wrong. And who can resolve that? It has to be resolved. They are brother cultures. Islam.
That's right. To me, you look to me like brothers.
That's exactly who they are. And it's the same fight that is recorded, or it's the same archetype of Cain and Abel and Ea and Enki. It is their archetype.
Well, I like your hypothesis, Chrisanna, because that it's a very fractal omniverse, it jibes well with my meaning of truth and fractal omniverse patterns that exist as above, so below, as it were, in all expressions of the same entity, which is, you know, this enmity entity. So, is there anything? Well, first of all, the first thing is step away from the conflict, because it's not yours.
Exactly, and that conflict will resolve when those two groups come to terms with their brotherhood. They are brothers. They're from the same archetype. Their teachings are so similar that it's ridiculous. The Muslims don't practice circumcision. That seems to be the big difference with the Jews and the Muslims in terms of their history. Just in terms of their history and their archetype. And when those two can come to terms with their brotherhood, they will make peace. And until then, they'll just keep killing each other until there's nothing left to kill. Right now, they are in such chaos in terms of their reincarnational cycles. In terms of your reincarnational cycles, the two of them have had so many deaths, so many chaotic deaths, that they're just running themselves into a hole.
Well, not only that, but they're destroying our planet in the process. You know.
Yes, they are.
Can you just stop this stupid destruction?
Just stop it.
Just stop. Now, here's the thing. Why is it that they can't stop? Is it that there's something in the back that is still calling them, like that this is an old battle between two sister-in-laws? Or two sister-wives, in fact.
I didn't understand the question.
That, you know, now I'm just trying to remember, Ninti and Ninhursag? The women,
yes,
who sired Ea and Enki,
mm-hmm,
or the females, let's say, the females who sired these. Now, which one is it? One of them's a reptilian, and one of them's a humanoid. Is that right? And where did she come from? And who is she? You know, what's it all about?
Which one? Ninhursag was Enki and Ea's sister. She was a nurse, or a biologist.
All right, so, but they had a mother. They had different mothers, didn't they?
Yes, they did, and I have never been able to figure out who their mothers are.
Right.
I didn't find that it was stated in the material anywhere.
And that's an interesting thing, because there's going to be, will there be one of these mothers that will be jealous of the other mother, if you see what I mean?
Right.
Could we trace this energy all the way back to that sister jealousy?
Well, that would be interesting. I have not been able to figure out who Enki's mother was. I just don't know. If it was named, I didn't find it. And I did look, because the difference, the reason Enlil was the governor of Sumer was because his mother had a higher status than Enki's mother. So the way Sitchin wrote the materials, he didn't state who the mothers were. If it's in the literature, I just don't know what it is. But there was a difference, and that is the reason. Even though Enki was the eldest son, his mother had a lower ranking than Enlil's mother, so Enlil was the governor.
So it's still a ranking of females.
Totally. And here's what's interesting.
You know, because here's Christiana, you know, I've lived in communities, I've lived in co-ops and stuff like that. And I don't care what you say about men. You know, they can fight, but I've seen the worst cooperation or the most lack of cooperation between female family members.
I agree.
It's the worst thing. And what the heck's all that about? Have you got any insight into that? As, you know, how does it work? Why, you know, why are we plagued with this insane? I mean, it's insane, isn't it? It's an insane thing. Why is it? I mean, I'm asking you from the depths of my soul and from the depths of every man's soul on this planet and every woman's, maybe. Any idea?
You know, honestly, my honest answer to that is that you see those differences from early childhood. I mean, early childhood. The differences between the little girls and the little boys and their psychology. It's hormonal. That's one thing. When my son was born, I said, I am going to be the perfect mother. I am not going to give him all of my ideas about what boys should do. Well, and I didn't. But let me tell you, by the time he was 18 months old, definitely by the time he was 3, he would kill you for a car, you know, a toy car. He wouldn't really kill you. He's actually a very peaceable baby and man. But it was like, it was all the snakes and snails and puppy dog tails, all the traditional trappings that little boys like, he had adopted them.
Excellent. Yeah.
He did not get them from me. I gave him dolls to play with. I encouraged him to develop his personality. Well, by the time he was 12 or 13, I had little girls come to my house and offer to do my dishes because they wanted to be around my son. Honestly.
Babe magnet.
He was a babe magnet, but it was, the point is that he, at that point, had almost no awareness of girls. The girls were all over him. Right, at a young age.
Bless.
And there is something about this nesting instinct. It has to do with hormones, and it has to do with dominance. That is my answer to that. There are exceptions to that. They are not, it's not a hard and fast rule, but I see it very clearly in, you can see it in kids in a second grade class, these differences that they just exist. And I think it has to do a lot with the hormones.
Okay.
I'll probably get hate letters, you know, for that.
Well,
and let me tell you, I as a little girl, I had two sisters. We played football. We were hellions. And no boy better bother with us because we would let them know just where it stands. But there was still a hormonal thing, despite the social behavior.
So having traced the conflict on Earth to a couple of sister wives who were a little jealous of each other's status, or, I mean, basically it seems that there was one that was not respected. This is the whole thing, you know. You don't listen to me,
yes.
You're never respected, and you never respect me, and, you know. And that's where it all, you know, like, you're daddy's little girl, and I'm the ugly one, and, you know, you're the pretty one. And it, there's always this thing, you know, like, look how shiny you are, and look how, you know, how dusty we are, and all this stuff.
Right.
And it's like, it comes back to, you know, and perhaps this is where the Aldebaranian influence comes in, is this whole thing about, you know, being superior. And like you say, the account was written from the winner of the conflict point of view.
Right.
Go ahead.
No, that's all. You just cannot overestimate the role of the morphogenetic field in our evolution, and we are really live very close to our animal instinct because we're still such a young species. As a species, we have not developed the higher energy centers that brings in higher awareness or awareness of the cosmos. By the way, I put up a number of documents that I thought might be of interest in this interview on paralleldimensions.us. It's my website. And I have one called Cosmic Human Species. It's in the document called Human Storm. We are coming out of a literal gestation. We are the descendants of reptiles. We still carry a very heavy reptile energy. That's why we have a reptilian brain. And no matter how evolved our foreparents were, our ancestors, we on this planet still must evolve through this ourselves. We must collectively, as a species, develop the higher energy centers. The Hopi call it, you know, the crown chakra, the door on top of your head. And the majority of people on this planet in this time in our evolution are in the lower three chakras. You know, the solar plexus, the control mechanisms of the solar plexus is where a lot of people are stuck. And you can, and I'm telling you, you can engineer that into a race. You do it by giving them a heavy adrenal function, because the solar plexus is tied to the adrenal glands. You've got to get that energy through the heart, beyond the heart, and that is the chakra that influences the heart is the thymus, and that is the endocrine gland that surgeons used to just cut out because they thought it was left over from our early evolution, right? Our thymus is at a very low function because we as a species have not really yet developed it and opened it to bring that heart energy in. And then from that, you can go into your higher perceptions. And that's sort of where we are right now. We're as a species in our evolution. So we still live real close to those first three chakras. And that is where your animal instinct feeds in. At death, the four lower energy bodies, you know, the astral, the etheric, and so on, they drop away. What survives beyond death are the energy bodies connected to the higher chakras. That's your immortal soul. And beneath that, I won't call it beneath it because without it, we wouldn't have a species. But subsequent to that, you develop your, not just develop, but resolve, those first three and then four chakras. The fourth, the heart chakra, is your swing chakra. Once you can get that activity into the thymus and the heart chakra, now you can move it up into the pituitary, the pineal, and the crown chakra. You become a cosmic species because you develop your cosmic connection through those higher three chakras. That's my theory on how that works.
Fantastic. So you've written, therefore, a series of books which takes everybody through this. And paralleldimensions.us is where you're from. I mean, I think we could have quite a few shows just talking about random stuff. That you've got a lot of pieces of the puzzle, it seems. Thank you very much.
Well, until you come to terms with the morphogenetic memory that forms, that is formative in your species, in our behaviors, because we're talking about the Sumerian descendants, we're talking about the Germanic descendants, we're talking about Native Americans. What we're really talking about is our human species. They've been separated. They've been pitted against each other for political reasons by ET groups that really want to dominate us, because by dominating human species, they can dominate the planet, get what they want. So we've been pitted against each other. We haven't been able to really get a handle on it because we just didn't have the evolution. We had not yet developed our energy systems, our memory, and our knowledge base. So we're at the point now where we can do that. We can start doing that with the end of the what I call the gestation in 2012. And once we do that, we can change it. But you've got to know what it is. You've got to know that you are influenced by memory. Not just your memory, racial memory, planetary memory. The Earth has a memory. She has a history. You might call it the Akashic Records. And we've got to develop the capacity to really tap into all this information that's contained in the fields that shape our planet, that shape our species, and shape the conditions of our life. And then we can causatively change them. We can rewrite the future once we understand and have a handle and a command of the memory that we carry, largely unknowingly now.
That's right. This is part of knowing who we are, is knowing where we come from, knowing what we are, what we're supposed to be. I've found that once I discovered that this is a vehicle that I can, it's like an RV, and it's got stuff like RVs have, it's got like air conditioning and facilities. It might have a little reversing camera at the back. That's quite a modern invention. You can have a little screen and you can see behind you. These are little facilities, and I believe that the human body is very much like that. It's got all these sensoria, which are like the being able to see in the visible spectrum. Being able to hear in the audible spectrum and things like that. But we've got many more than just the five, I believe.
I agree with you.
And this is all how the that these are all dormant until you realize that you can do it. Until somebody asks you to read the Akashic Records, you don't know that you can read the Akashic Records, do you?
Right. So, or you may be reading them and not know what they are.
Exactly. Exactly. It might just be common sense.
So that's where we are as a species. And we really, actually, my contact at this point, very recently, told me they want me to start working with people to help them get oriented to the present as a soul. In other words, you're here as a soul, you have a history, and you have a future. And once you can get a grip on those sequences and those relationships, you can start commanding your destiny. And we've just been in a position now where reincarnation has been wiped out from our cultural knowledge base. We're slowly bringing it back in. Until you really resolve that identity as a soul and its history and its future, you're just kind of wandering around, falling into the animal instinct sometimes. Sometimes you hit the sublime and it's wonderful, but you don't know why it's happening or how it's happening. So an orientation process is in order to give us a command of our future and our present by understanding how these memories affect us in the present.
Well, you certainly, I was going to say painted a picture, but you haven't painted a picture. You've created a sculpture, but it's more like created a moulding, like a cutting bit that show or there's another word. It's full of little pieces of wire that take the form as you know, but I don't know what it's called. Somebody's going to come in there. Anyway, it shows the template of the, that's probably what it's called, a template. It shows the template of the pattern of things. And we kind of gotten to the nub of the matter, really. And, you know, what do you do with a family history? You know, how do you resolve a family history like that? Maybe we could just take, I mean, these stories occur all over the world in all of our folklore about what happens to the lost and the abandoned among us. They're part of us, and we have to remember that. And
that's
so,
right.
You know, you look like brothers. You are brothers. To me, you're all brothers. So, you know, stop hitting each other and start hugging each other and start saying, I'm sorry.
You know? Right, or at least make peace so you can both survive. Stop trying to destroy each other and just survive and create a future together, because you are going to be together for a long, long time. That soul connection is not going to go away. It just gets bigger and it gets more pressing the more aware you become.
And so the Middle East conflict is not somebody else's problem. It's our problem. It's our inner problem, what's going on inside of us.
Yes, as a species. Absolutely it is. And that's why it's all over us. That's why it is affecting us so much. If it were just an insular problem, it would just, you know, go away. It would just pass by us, but it's not doing that. And it affects America to a huge extent, because we are the melting pot.
That's right.
The modern melting pot.
And here comes the cinnamon.
Exactly. So a lot of the stuff comes from America, because we've integrated, we've assimilated the world into this melting pot. And then the alliances and the issues flow back out. You know, Helena Blavatsky said that America would be the first to be corrupted, because we have no philosophy. And it's true. America is the first nation to rise to power without a state religion. But also, because of the confluence of the world that came here, we don't have a clear-cut philosophy. And that's probably what we need to really be working on, is a philosophy that really works for the modern world.
We're at the end of the show, Chrisanna, and I just want to say thank you so much. You've really, it's been like a zipper. It's like, you know, fixing, you know, bringing things together, joining some dots all the way from year dot to now. We've got about a minute left, but thank you so much.
Thank you.
And maybe we'll connect together and do some more of this, because this really works well nicely. Thank you.
And I'll send you that book.
Oh.
That it's an electronic book. I'll send it to you.
Fantastic. I love that stuff.
you'll like it.
Yeah, excellent. So thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
There was something that I wanted to add, and it'll probably be lost in the mix as it goes out of the show, as we're going. So I'll find it. We'll.
Okay.
Good night, everybody. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Have a good week.
Thank you.